Welcome to WISO Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. On today's program, we've got information on the Dayton Progress Manufacturing Challenge, a competition for area high schools. Ellen Belcher has Politics Ohio, and Bob Brecka from the University of Dayton Physics Department on this month's Sochi Talks. All that and more. Up first, Jean Howard Berry is the Education and Outreach Manager for City Folk. She's going to tell us about the event Soul Rhythms taking place this afternoon at the Dayton Masonic Center.
This is the culmination of a seven-week residency project that incorporates five different strands, five cultures in five schools, all five having worked on the theme of migration. So the performance this afternoon brings all the pieces together in sort of a tour de force performance. So we're super excited about it.
What was the genesis for this event?
Well, our program, Culture Builds Community, is growing into a year-round program as it's sort of organically coming together, but it has been very specifically a residency project where we try to immerse school children in particular cultures and in particular disciplines. So the genesis is really City Folk as an educating, presenting organization, doing traditional music, growing into schools where we can get, you know, more specific about details and some, you know, go below the iceberg level and get detailed about each of these cultures. So,
what has the response been from students?
Actually, really positive. It's interesting because each school has its very distinct culture, and so they've, as I mentioned, immersed sort of in that culture. But we've sort of organized a curriculum of activities to do that cover all five of the particular cultures so they can get a taste of it and have a sense of the bigger picture. And so as we're coming together for the performance, they have a little bit of an understanding of each of the cultures being presented. So it's really kind of cool that way. I think it broadens the experience.
We can get more information on the event later today from City Folk's website.
Right, www.cityfolk.org.
Jean Howitt Berry, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
A local company has initiated a new scholarship competition for area high schools. The Dayton Progress Manufacturing Challenge will provide a big money prize to a high school that submits the winning entry and does the best job of raising awareness of career opportunities in manufacturing. Alan Schaefer is president and CEO with Dayton Progress Corporation. He explains the reason behind the competition.
The real story is we didn't used to have to promote careers in manufacturing. We were the world leader in it. We still are, but most people don't realize it. And so we're trying to reach out to young people while they're still at the beginning of their career decision phase in high school and offer the opportunity that they can consider a career in manufacturing with or without a college degree.
So let's talk a little bit about the situation that's creating this need that you've seen.
We have a resurgence of manufacturing in the United States. A recent survey by the Manufacturing Institute and Deloitte Consulting showed that there's over 600,000 unfilled jobs in manufacturing today for skilled workers, and that 83% of companies are experiencing that shortage. We're one of them.
And how does that happen when unemployment is as high as it is, 600,000 jobs unfilled?
When's the last time you read an article about manufacturing that didn't sound bad? Oh, it's moving offshore. There's not as many people in it. Everybody needs to get a college degree. Why would you want to work in a factory?
Let's talk about this need for manufacturing jobs coming back.
Well, first off, the American workforce is very productive. We have tripled the amount of productivity the average American has since 1970. And while we've sent a lot of work offshore since 2000, predominantly to China, it's been the most manual of jobs. And I think if you ask young people, did you want one of those jobs anyway, they'd probably say no.
And so what are the reasons that people aren't prepared to take those jobs on right now?
Nothing in the news makes people interested in it. Nothing in the secondary education system is telling kids that this is a viable career option for you. Most high schools are geared towards getting all those kids in college, even though we know half of them won't go. Right now, just in the Dayton area alone, we have 2,400 manufacturers employing over 100,000 people. And we manufacturers here need to hire at least 3,000 or 4,000 people a year to replace retirements. And yet we've got a generational problem. I'm a baby boomer, as you are. Our kids are Generation X. There are 9 million fewer people in Generation X than the boomers. And so for every 10 of us who retire, there's only 9 of them. In Ohio alone, there's going to be a 12% decline in high school students graduating from 2009 to 2022. Just fewer people. And combine that with people aren't being aware of manufacturing for being the great career opportunity it is, we have a problem in workforce. At our company, in the next 15 years, half of our entire workforce will reach normal full retirement age as defined by Social Security. So we're going to be like a typical company and replacing half the workforce over the next 15 years. There's never been a better time for a young person to get into manufacturing. Can you imagine the career advancement opportunities at a company that replaces half the workforce in that short period of time?
Is your situation typical then of other companies?
I believe it has to be. We're all mature manufacturers. We were started in 1946, just like so many other companies were. And people stay a long time at a good manufacturer. Our average employee has been here for over 23 years.
You've got a dip in the population that's going to be able to take these manufacturing jobs, but now you've got open jobs that are ready to be had. How do you make those numbers meet?
It's very difficult. We went through 3,600 applicants in the last 18 months just to net out 100 people to be hired.
What were the results of that effort?
Well, we found a lot of things. We found that people wanted to stay on the extended unemployment benefits the government enacted. We found people who lied on their application about their job or about criminal background. We found people who failed the criminal background check, people who couldn't pass the drug test, people who had worked at, let's say, an assembly plant, where they really didn't get any manufacturing skills after being there 20 or 30 years, and they have expectation of very high pay and benefits, but no skills to offer to earn those.
So you're putting this out to schools to increase awareness of that need.
That's right. We want to reward them for doing that. And so the school district that wins will receive 3 computers loaded with state-of-the-art computer-aided design software for manufacturing. 5 of their students will receive a $1,000 each scholarship to the Step 2 machining program at Sinclair Community College. And from among the top 3 placing schools, we'll hire 4 students for after-school internships, and those jobs will lead to a permanent job offer upon graduation.
So let's talk about what they got to do to get that.
They have to be creative. They have to find a creative way throughout the entire school year to promote the idea that manufacturing careers are a viable option for you, and here's what you need to do to prepare yourself for that or research it to see if you really would like it. We hope that with the programs the schools are going to implement under our challenge, we'll have the opportunity to go in and talk to the students and their parents as well and show them things such as the income opportunities. You know, the average high school dropout in the United States last year earned a little over $23,000. The average high school graduate of all ages earned $33,500. Our first-year entry-level people beat that. The average person in Ohio last year, all ages with all levels of education, earned less than $41,000. Our intermediate-level skilled people beat that significantly. And in the United States, all 4-year college graduates of all ages at all jobs last year earned less than $55,000 a year. Our skilled level people beat that significantly without a college degree. And if they want one, at our company, we'll pay 100% of the tuition for the college degree and 100% of the cost of the books. It's hope and opportunity for young people instead of bad news about career dead ends for them. But manufacturing is alive and well. There's not a single job in this country that can be done without something that was manufactured. We feed the world with our manufacturing skill. We showed the world how to make everything. We're still the innovators. Tell me the name of the European Facebook. Who's the European Apple? It took 11 countries, I think, to create Airbus, and they still can't compete against Boeing, an American manufacturer of aircraft. We're the largest car companies. We still innovate in the car technologies. We're still a leader. 12 million Americans produce 20% of all the goods on this planet, and they make a good living doing it. If you're a young person, this is a great opportunity for you. If you're the parent of a young person, tell them to think about it.
Alan Schaefer with Dayton Progress, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. Up next, Soshi Talks is designed to enlighten the world with knowledge from primarily institutions of higher education in Southwest Ohio. To coincide with Earth Day this weekend, today we'll hear from Bob Brekka of the University of Dayton Physics Department on why we need a renewable energy revolution.
Several years ago, I became increasingly interested in climate change and energy issues and began changing the focus of my own research to these areas. I've been working with UD students and faculty to investigate ways to determine the most promising energy efficiency measures that can be made to homes and small businesses. Another part of my research has been carried out in conjunction with scientists and economists at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research in Germany, where I just spent the 2010-2011 academic year as a visiting scientist and Fulbright Fellow. I'm going to summarize here in very general terms some of the work in which I've been involved, and more generally, talk about why I'm convinced that we must embrace a revolution in energy over the next few decades, transforming the way we power our society to a more sustainable and efficient system based on renewable resources. My starting point is the reality of global climate change. I should just mention that this terminology is not a retreat, as claimed by some, but rather a decades-old characterization of what scientists expect will happen due to continued burning of fossil fuels. The basic outline of how our climate functions has been known for over a century and represents an application of basic physics and chemistry learned in first-year college courses. In addition to increasing global average temperature, which has been clearly observed for many decades, many other changes are taking place, such as rising sea levels and acidification of the oceans. These changes, thus far relatively small, are likely to be irreversible on the scale of many hundreds to thousands of years. One of the most worrisome features of these changes for many climate scientists is the rapidity with which they are occurring, compared to the customary slow pace of natural Earth changes. Temperature changes over the past couple of decades have happened at a rate many times faster than the changes that occurred as the Northern Hemisphere emerged from the last glacial period 10,000 years ago. Although it's not possible to define a perfect temperature for human societies to thrive, in various locations around the world, civilizations have developed under very constant conditions over the past several thousand years. It's rapid changes in these previously stable conditions that will be particularly disruptive. A prudent approach to being a steward of our planet, whether motivated by religious or spiritual or secular concerns, is to not risk the well-being of future generations and of the least well-off in the world. This is especially true as a guiding principle if our best scientific knowledge leads to a fairly clear understanding of the potentially harmful and irreversible consequences of our actions. In one sense, we're very lucky that our scientific understanding of Earth systems and climate has developed enough to warn us about effects that might come into play on longer timescales than we normally consider for societal decision-making. Climate change bears potential risks, and disproportionately so for those least able to adapt to changing climate conditions. It's remarkable to look at a map of the world and note that those countries most at risk from a changing climate are almost uniformly not those that have profited the most from using fossil fuels. Scientists look at how greenhouse gases are linked to eventual climate change. It's a good approximation to say that changes will occur based on the total amount of fossil fuel combustion, independent of when it occurs or how quickly it occurs. The amount of fossil fuels in the ground is much larger than the amount that can be used without causing disruptive climate change. Since the U.S. has committed to both working toward agreements to maintain global temperature changes below 2 degrees Celsius and to avoiding dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system, there's a need to dramatically reduce emissions within the next decade or two if we are to avoid the likelihood of the most negative consequences of climate change. Wealthy countries who have become so, mainly through the consumption of fossil fuels over the past century, must lead the way in implementing and improving upon existing low-carbon technologies and in improving the efficiency with which we use energy. World use of energy has increased so rapidly that of all the fossil fuels that have ever been consumed, roughly 75% of that has been in my lifetime. It's clear that energy is crucial, both in our industrialized societies and, perhaps as importantly, in those societies that need access to energy to increase their standard of living and rise out of poverty. But the key point is that we need access to energy, not necessarily to fossil fuel energy. There are some who fear the transition over the next several decades to a carbon-free economy. However, there are actually many pathways available for achieving this goal, as has been shown by economic and energy system modeling done by research groups around the world, including the one I've worked with in Potsdam, Germany. One constant factor, however, is the need to develop and integrate renewable energy technologies on a very large scale. We have abundant renewable resources, and renewable energy technologies are continually becoming cheaper, even though worldwide subsidies to fossil fuels still far outstrip those to renewables, according to the International Energy Agency. If the externalized costs of fossil fuels, those items paid for only indirectly by consumers, were factored in fully, the economic case for renewables would likely be easy to make even today. And there are already more jobs in the U.S. in the renewable energy industries than in the entire coal industry, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. This is not to say that a transition will be without effort. Many renewable resources have the disadvantage, for example, that they fluctuate in time. However, challenges of this type are exactly where our engineers and scientists will play a large role in developing storage capabilities and the smart electrical grid to complement the new energy technologies. As we move toward an energy system highly dependent on renewable resources, we have an opportunity to think in an integrated way about all sectors that use energy, from industries to households to transportation. Our current energy system arose in a haphazard, unplanned way as various fossil fuels and energy conversion technologies became available. The electric grid, although a marvel of engineering, is in dire need of modernization. Our internal combustion engines are basically the same, relatively inefficient devices our grandparents used, and our buildings are mostly remnants of a time when energy was cheap and seemingly endlessly plentiful. The opportunity of the generation represented by my students is to reimagine all of these systems in a coherent way, optimizing not only each element, but also the ways in which they interact with one another, and to do so in a way that will be sustainable for generations into the future. Imagine, for example, large amounts of renewable energy being at the heart of the energy system. At times of excess production, the renewable electricity can be used to charge electric vehicles or perhaps to create hydrogen and even methane or natural gas from water and carbon dioxide. These gases can be stored and transported using our existing pipeline infrastructure, then used in turn to generate electricity at times when there's a lack of renewable electricity. This version of an energy system turns the current model on its head. Renewables would now be the workhorse, and the more old-fashioned technologies would jump in when needed. Of course, we would also work to make sure that gas-fired electricity, for example, is generated as efficiently as possible, with so-called combined cycle plants, and that the inevitable waste heat that is generated during the generation of electricity is also used for domestic hot water, district heating, and manufacturing processes. Having spent the year in Germany, it was fascinating to experience the enthusiasm with which energy issues were being discussed. An important question to ask is why this renewable energy revolution can be taking place in Germany and several other European countries, and has not yet taken off in the U.S., at least not with such a broad societal consensus. There is a curious reluctance to embrace these changes on a large scale by our society. Traditionally, we like to see ourselves as can-do people, but somewhere along the way we became bogged down in the attitude that we can't do it when it comes to energy, and we've allowed discussions about climate change to become political when understanding the Earth's climate is a question of dispassionate scientific research. The energy transformation that will happen sooner or later is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity and challenge. We're facing the uncertain effects of climate change, suffering from high and unstable costs of fossil fuels that are becoming increasingly difficult to extract, and worried about national security, our dependence on foreign energy sources, need for new jobs, and large trade imbalances. It's a remarkable reality that all of these problems can be addressed, at least to some degree, by taking advantage of the opportunity now presented by renewable energy. Very seldom can we solve multiple problems with one set of actions. But exactly that is the promise of the future if we choose to take advantage of it.
So She Talks, that's Bob Brekka of the University of Dayton. You can hear more conversations like this one online at soche.org.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Ellen Belcher, filling in for Emily McCord. I'm talking today with Ohio Secretary of State John Husted, a Republican and former state lawmaker from Kettering. Thanks so much for your time, Secretary Husted.
Thanks, Ellen.
As the state's chief elections officer, you're in the middle of a controversy about Ohio's election laws. Republicans passed a bundle of changes last year that critics say are designed to suppress Democratic turnout. They have enough signatures to ask voters to repeal what Republicans said were reforms. First, let's talk about the changes that would be in effect if Democrats had not succeeded in putting a hold on the whole ball of wax by getting enough signatures for a referendum. Arguably, the most controversial changes are to shorten early voting from 35 to 21 days before an election and to prohibit in-person voting on the weekend before the election. Why limit the early voting window? And specifically, why stop voting at 6 p.m. on the Friday right before an election?
First of all, you have the Golden Week, which under current law allows people to start voting 35 days before the election. You can register to vote up until 30 days before the election. So you have this five-day window where you can register to vote and vote on the same day. There are a lot of concerns that have been expressed, and there have been a few examples of documented voter fraud. And once that vote is casted, you can't take it back. And so something less than 30 days would prevent that problem. 21 is what the General Assembly settled on. I would be fine with anything less than 30 days because then we could take that off the table. And I don't think that any reasonable person can argue that whether it's 30 days or 29 days or 21 days, that that's somehow voter suppression. And as far as the cutoff for a Friday prior to the Tuesday election, that is to allow the Board of Elections, and we got this based on feedback that we received from the Board of Elections. There was bipartisan support for this coming out of the Boards of Elections to end voting on the Friday before so that they would have time to organize, redeploy their machines, and set up for the Tuesday election.
Weren't there some election officials who liked the weekend voting because that cut down on the lines and the number of people, particularly in presidential election years, on election day itself?
There is a broad diversity of opinion on election issues as there is on almost anything, and I'm sure that there were some people out there that liked it. I can only work in consensus as best as we can in working with the local officials, working with their state association. It was a recommendation from the state association that I actually agreed with. It will never be easier to vote in Ohio than it will be this year because I'm sending out absentee ballot applications to voters in all 88 counties. So all they have to do is fill that form out, send it back into the Board of Elections. The Board of Elections will send them a ballot to their home, and they can vote right from their kitchen table. What we have to try to figure out is a balance between voter access and vote security, making sure that we make it easy for people as possible to vote, but also make sure we have safeguards in place so that fraud and the things that have been discussed during the elections process are reasonably guarded against. At a time when governments don't have the resources that they have traditionally had, it's not a 7-Eleven. You can't keep it open 24/7. There's a cost to doing this. We're trying to find a reasonable solution, a reasonable time frame in which to do that.
Things have gotten really confusing now that the Republican-controlled Ohio Senate has voted to repeal the changes that it passed last year. It looks like the House is going to follow suit. Democrats, however, say they have a winning issue, and they're saying, whoa, wait a minute, you can't undo your mistake. You have to let the people vote on your handiwork. They think voters will reject the Republicans' changes. You oppose voters deciding the matter. Help us understand that.
Well, I don't oppose voters to it. I think basically that it would be great if we could resolve this issue thoughtfully. And what I mean by that is to go ahead and start over and try to resolve the matters on a bipartisan basis. Democrats and Republicans are fighting like the Hatfields and McCoys over even the most modest changes to the law. So I suggested and had bipartisan support from the boards of elections around the state that the legislature just repeal the law and we start over after the election. And initially, my own Republican friends in the legislature rejected my idea. but eventually they came around to it. I don't understand why Democrats would object to it, because that's been their goal all along.
I've been talking with Ohio Secretary of State John Husted. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts today.
Thanks.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the fourth week of middle spring, the week of Cross Quarter Day, April 21st. "Surely there is a great word being put together here," writes Wendell Berry. "I begin to hear it gather in the opening of the flowers and the leafing out of the trees, in my thoughts moving in the hill's flesh." The great word that Wendell Berry invokes continues to be spoken throughout the week of Cross Quarter Day, when the sun enters Taurus and reaches halfway to equinox, and when on the same day the old cabbage butterfly moon becomes the new frog and toad mating moon, moving high overhead at noon and telling every gardener and farmer to be planting. In the woodlots and parks, phlox and ragwort are purple and gold. May apples are flowering. Wild ginger, meadow rue, bellwort, the jack in the pulpit, and thyme-leafed speedwell are blossoming. On the farm, some orchard grass and rye are ready to harvest, and bluegrass is budding. Webworms and tent caterpillars are emerging in the fruit trees, and weevils appear in the lanky alfalfa. Red and white clover open in the pasture. Around town, mock orange season, Korean lilac season, and honeysuckle season announce the most fragrant time of the year. Iris, poppies, and peonies complement the fragrance. Clematis season graces garden trellises. Lily of the Valley and Star of Bethlehem open beneath them. Along the freeways, daisies, yellow sweet clover, meadow goat's beard, and parsnips flower. Blackberry and elderberry bushes bloom in the hedgerows. Cobwebs appear overnight, glistening with morning dew, and in the night of Cross Quarter Day, the lurid meteors fly across the southeastern sky near the summer triangle, all of them joining in putting together the great word that Wendell Berry heard. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first week of late spring. In the meantime, if you really listen for the great word, you will hear it.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
This is WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for listening. The Laramie Project is a play that deals with the brutal 1998 kidnapping and murder of Matthew Shepard in Laramie, Wyoming. Matthew Shepard was murdered because he was gay. In preparation for the local premiere of this prize-winning play, Sinclair Community College will welcome Greg Pirotti of the Tectonic Theater Project April 30th through May 2nd. Sinclair will host a week-long series of events, including readings and workshops exploring themes of intolerance, compassion, and acceptance. Coming up next week on WISO Weekend, a conversation with Stephen Skiles. He chairs the theater and dance department at Sinclair College. We'll talk about the Laramie Project events. Now here's Sarah Buckingham with a preview of tonight's Sunday Documentary Hour.
Friday marked the two-year anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Tonight, Alex Chadwick takes us to the Gulf Coast in his documentary, The Hunt for Oil, from the series Burn, an energy journal. Chadwick explores where all that oil went and how the people and ecosystems of the Gulf are holding up. We also visit another important petroleum exploration site, Covenant Oil Field in Utah. We all know the big names in oil and gas like BP and Chevron, but most of the oil and gas wells in the U.S. are owned by small independent operators like Wolverine Gas and Oil Corporation. In 2003, playing out a hunch, Wolverine owner Sid Jansma hit it big in Covenant. Alex goes to that oil field with Jansma to talk about the uncertain business of oil exploration. Other stories in this hour include oil pipelines. There are tens of thousands of miles of them crisscrossing the U.S., and it's a vital and cost-effective mode of fuel transportation. But many of the pipelines are old, and sometimes they leak, causing harm to people and the environment. And the cost of a gallon of gas. It's more than supply and demand that determines the price. So what is oil? How can you find it? How is it extracted, refined, transported, and utilized? Could we get along without it? These are some of the issues Alex Chadwick reports on in The Hunt for Oil, tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. on the Sunday Documentary Hour.
That's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all of our guests, and thanks for joining us on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. Coming up next, the Book Nook.